Welcome, everybody. This is the eighth and final lecture of the Mises Academy online class, Anatomy of the Fed. Today is August 13th, 2012, and we are going to just basically be wrapping up all sorts of stuff. We have some things from last week that I didn't get to, but I didn't want to rush through them last week, so I carry them through till tonight. And then we also, I want to hit very quickly this issue of the rule change that the Fed made in January of 2011. So I have a specific numerical example. And then what the topic for today was supposed to be is some U.S. business cycles. Let me say it right now before I forget. I just want to make sure I hit this point. I don't think I had a slide dedicated to it. But remember, Austrian business cycle theory does not say the central bank causes the business cycle. What Austrian business cycle theory says in the tradition of Mises and Hayek and Rothbard is that fractional reserve banking is the primary conduit or mechanism, and specifically it's interest rates being pushed below what they should be. All right, and I'm avoiding certain terminology because different writers have different usages. All right, now, having said all that, and again, in the Q&A, if people want to raise this stuff, I can weigh in on it. You have to be careful because there is what's again called this free banking school of modern Austrians who think fractional reserve banking per se is okay and that you could have a healthy, sustainably growing economy even with fractional reserve banking, whereas other Austrians like Joe Salerno, guys like that, don't think that's true. And you can find, even in Mises, conflicting passages that it's not clear what was Mises' own position on that question. But for sure, what is not up for debate is that Mises, in his original exposition and then later in Human Action and so on, he was not saying he was not saying the business cycle is caused by the central bank. He was saying it's caused when the banks, meaning the commercial banks, inflate and push interest rates below what they should be, and this gives rise to an unsustainable boom. So again, I'm just repeating stuff from earlier lectures. So why are Austrians, why do they tend to be in such a tizzy over the central bank then? And why is it that we nowadays, if we're talking about what happened with the housing bubble, why do we always talk about, oh, well, what Greenspan did was blah, blah, blah. Why are we making it about the Fed, apparently? Well, because in the Rothbardian analysis, which I happen to think is right, one of the things that the central bank does is severely defang the market's normal tendencies or normal mechanisms for restraining fractional reserve banking. So even if there's no law against fractional reserve banking, even if that's perfectly permissible legally, and all that happens is the government makes banks honor their contracts like any other business, and if they get caught during a bank run, then they go out of business. If that's the only, or if that's all the government did, as opposed to an outright prohibition, still, you could tell a story about feedback mechanisms and other such things, competition among banks issuing their own notes and so forth, that would lead to a competitive equilibrium where reserve ratio would be some number and it wouldn't be zero and it wouldn't be 1% or 2%. I don't know how high it would be. I kind of think it would be fairly high. Other people might think it would be lower. But the point is there would be this natural market tendency to restrain fractional reserve banking so that one bank couldn't just start inflating because then it would quickly lose its reserves to all of its peers. And even if at any given time all the big banks in the industry all got together and colluded and said, hey, let's just inflate together and so we won't be draining our reserves from each other, we'll all just inflate hand in hand. Even if they did do that, the more they inflated, the bigger the opportunity for some new person to enter the banking industry and have a higher reserve ratio than the people currently in it, and then slowly drain their reserves over time until they finally would have to abandon their inflationary path and at least match the reserve ratio of this newcomer. All right, so that's what would happen in a banking sector that had free entry and competition and no special government privileges, just standard enforcement of contracts. So Rothbard thinks that what the central bank does, among other things, is come in and cartelize the industry, make it really hard for newcomers to enter the banking sector. You can't just open a bank next week if you fill out some forms. It's really hard to open up a commercial bank in the United States. And then also by acting as a lender of last resort, which everybody agrees is one of the chief functions of a central bank, even people who think that's a great thing, Rothbard points out how look at that would make you much more likely to inflate. It takes away one of the things, one of the bad things that happens in a genuine market when if you inflate too much and you get hit with a run, even if you've made good investments and so your assets match or exceed your liabilities, if your maturity mismatch is there, which is what happens if you borrow short and lend long, then you're dead. But not if there's a central bank waiting in the wings that can create money out of thin air and lend it to you, then there's no downside of inflating too much as long as you invest the funds accordingly, right? If you make bad loans, then you're going to go out of business no matter what. But the point is, not no matter what, as we've seen, but you get what I'm saying. All right, so the point is, you don't need a central bank to explain Austrian business cycle theory or for Austrian business cycle theory to kick in. Mises developed what we now call Austrian business cycle theory partly based on the historical evidence of when certain places didn't have a central bank. All right, so he drew on various schools of thought, and it wasn't like they were all looking at business cycle history from periods where a central bank didn't necessarily exist. And so it's true rhetorically, modern Austrians sometimes leave themselves open to an obvious objection when they make it sound like the Fed causes recessions. And I'm sure I've said that too, that, oh yeah, the Fed caused the housing bubble or something. If I'm on a radio or something, 9 o'clock in the morning, people are driving to work and I'm getting interviewed for two commercial breaks, I may somewhat carelessly or loosely say, oh yeah, the Fed caused the housing bubble. But the danger of saying that then is a critic can come back to you and say, you idiots, how could there be boom bust cycles then before 1913 if that's what you think? And even in between when there was a central bank. So they, as we'll see in a minute, there were predecessors of the Fed where the US had a central bank, but the critics could say even in periods where there was no central bank at all, there were clearly boom-bust cycles, and so you Austrians are not, again, that's just because they're going off of something we might have written in an op-ed or something that Peter Schiff could have said in a radio interview. The historical scholarly Austrian theory of the business cycle by no means was tied up with the central bank per se. Okay. So extraordinary program. So this is what I was carrying over from week 7. So a lot of this is just details that it's not like I have to offer any theoretical insight. So I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. If you're curious, obviously just get the PowerPoint yourself. So one of the things though I want to mention with some of these, I just want you to be aware of these dates. Okay, so this one, for example, a term auction facility was opened up in December of 07. So just remember your timeline. That's now ex post when the National Bureau of Economic Research dated the beginning of the recession this time around. But at the time, people didn't know we were in a recession. I mean, Austrians did. Even though I was horribly botched the call and was arguing with Peter Schiff about it earlier in the year, by the fall of 2007, I knew this was going to be a bad recession, and I was even saying this is going to be as bad as the one in the early 80s. But what I'm saying is, as of December of 2007, it wasn't like the intelligentsia and the punditry class were all saying, oh my gosh, we're in a recession. It wasn't as obvious. It wasn't only until later that the NBER and the other official organizations said, we're in a recession, and we think it started in December of 07. But the point is, things were breaking down in certain sectors, in the credit markets and so forth, such that the Fed had to open up this term option facility as early as December of 07. So there, it wasn't like things were humming along nicely, and then all of a sudden, boom, the economy fell apart. Things kept gradually getting worse and worse and spreading. And so that's, I'm just reminding you guys in case you don't remember how this thing was unfolding. And it's funny just to see the commentary from people at the time. And the absolute worst was Ben Bernanke. And you guys, if you've never seen this, this is hilarious. Go to YouTube and type in Ben Bernanke was wrong. And it will be a compilation. It's like, depending on which version you get, like 4 to 6 minutes of Bernanke clips going back to like 2005 from before he was Fed chair when he was just on the Council of Economic Advisors. Just time and time again, at every stage of coming up to the crash and then post-crash, Bernanke's wrong. Like, in the beginning, he's saying, I think we're going to be fine. I don't think we have a housing bubble. And he's saying that in, like, 2005. And then once it's clear there was a housing bubble and housing now is collapsing, he says, well, I think it's just going to be contained here. It's true there's some subprime mortgages that are a problem, but that's going to be it. Then once it started spreading, he goes, yep, we're probably going to have a recession, but we think it's going to be over by such and such. I mean, just at every step of the way, he kept minimizing, downplaying how bad things were going to be. So either he's stupid or he's a liar, right? And I don't know which, or some would say some combination. In other words, it's possible he knew full well that we were headed for a really awful crisis and was just going out in front of the camera and trying to soothe people and trying to postpone the panic as long as possible. So it's just be careful when you see stuff like that. Don't just automatically assume, oh, my gosh, Ben Bernanke's an idiot. It's possible he knew full well what was coming, even more than we did, because he had access to more information. Okay, so these things, swap lines, that's very quickly what will happen there is the Fed will say to the ECB, okay, we'll give you a certain amount of dollars, or dollar reserves, and you give us a certain amount of euro reserves, and then we agree down the road at this particular date, we'll swap them back at the same exchange rate. And so they would do that so there was an exchange rate risk. Okay, meaning so in case the dollar moved one way or another against the euro, they didn't want the one party to then be at a disadvantage. So they would agree ahead of time that, you know, we're going to use the same exchange rate. And so why did they do that? Well, part of it is because the commercial banks in Europe were getting in trouble, and they wanted to be able to come up with so the commercial banks and investment banks in Europe needed to have dollars because a lot of their own liabilities were denominated in dollars, and U.S. institutions, when things started getting ugly, were afraid to lend them dollars anymore because they weren't sure, you know, everyone was freezing up. And so you wouldn't want to give it to a foreign firm. And so then they were getting in trouble, so they needed to get dollars. So they went to the ECB, but the ECB can't manufacture dollars, but what they can manufacture is euros. So then the ECB went to the Fed and said, hey, we can make euros at will. We can print up as many of those as we want, but we need dollars. How about we do a little swap there and you know, help a brother out? And Bernanke obliged, right? And so then this thing kicks in with more and more urgency and bigger amounts later on as the crisis kept getting bigger, especially in Europe, like as the Greek debt crisis and then that enlarged as the general sovereign debt crisis. The Fed would often sort of calm markets by just saying to the ECB, okay, here you go, here's a bunch of dollars, because private institutions were not willing to lend dollars to the European institutions, but good old Ben was. Okay, term securities lending facility. Here, the thing that was interesting about this one, let me just point out, was that the Fed was lending treasuries as opposed to actual dollar reserves. Okay, so in a lot of these programs, when the Fed's doing something, it's creating reserves out of thin air, so actual dollar reserves, and giving them to the institution that's borrowing it. Whereas the TSLF, what the Fed was doing was saying, okay, on our asset sheet, our balance sheet, we have treasuries, right, because the Fed, among other things, has been buying up a ton of treasuries. And so what we'll do here is the Fed would go to a primary dealer and would lend them treasuries in exchange or on the basis of with the collateral of things like residential mortgage-backed securities and agency debt. What that means in the context of the U.S. financial sector since 2008, when people talk about agency debt, what they probably mean are bonds issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Okay, so Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the institutions that the federal government sets up that sort of act as a clearinghouse. So if they'll buy up mortgages, so they're like a secondary market for mortgages. So commercial banks are more willing to grant a mortgage to new applicants for home, for, you know, people who want to buy a couple wants to buy a home. The commercial bank's more likely to grant that if they know Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are waiting in the wings to buy that mortgage off of them. Okay, so a bond issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is ultimately backed up by their portfolio of mortgages. So if you think the real estate market's tanking and there's going to be a huge amount of defaults on individual homeowners not paying their mortgage, well, a bond issued by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac all of a sudden doesn't look very attractive. And there's plenty of arguments about moral hazard and so forth about why did Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac get to be so big. And a lot of people were saying, well, because even before the federal government literally said so, there was this presumption in the financial markets that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were ultimately backstopped by the taxpayer, that people thought, I'm willing to lend money to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, meaning I'm going to buy their bonds, because even if something happened and the mortgages they're sitting on get in trouble, they're so prestigious, they're such a privileged thing where the government anointed them with this goal of promoting home ownership and giving mortgages to, you know, traditionally disadvantaged communities and stuff like that, where market forces normally might not approve the mortgage. That was part of the mission of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, was to lower the hurdles to home ownership for traditionally disadvantaged members of society. So the point was, the government probably isn't going to want to see Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac just collapse, because that would be embarrassing. And it would look like whoever was at the helm when that happened didn't care about the goal of helping minorities, you know, achieve the American dream and that kind of stuff. So the thinking is, the criticism is that interest rates for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, when they float their own bonds, were lower. In other words, they were able to borrow more cheaply than other institutions that may have been in a similar business. And so that's how they got to capture so much of the market. I don't know what the latest numbers are, but they're pretty astronomical since the crisis hit. And then the government really did formally take those things and take Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac over, so that they're explicitly now backed up by the taxpayer. It's something like just about all new mortgages issued post-crisis are absorbed by these two groups. All right, and again, I don't know the exact number of time, but it's a really high number, such that in a sense, you could say the federal government basically owns a large portion of the mortgages in the country right now. Okay. But just to make sure you understand the point here, so if you are a primary dealer, what would happen is, and you're sitting on a bunch of residential mortgage-backed securities and bonds issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that's not very good collateral, right? So if you're having short-term financing problems and you go into the standard credit markets and say, hey, I need to borrow some money because I have a bunch of bills coming due next week, I owe people cash, But hey, I have a bunch of assets, and the potential lenders say, well, what are you holding? They say, oh, I got all these residential mortgage-backed securities, and I got a bunch of bonds issued by Freddie Mac. So what do you say? Can I borrow $1 billion? You're going to say, no, that collateral is terrible. So what the Fed did with this term securities lending facility is said, you come to us, we're not going to give you dollar reserves. What we will give you is we will lend you our treasury bonds. And so then you can have those on your books to satisfy capital requirements and things like that. And we are okay if the way you get the loan from us, if what you put up is collateral, so in case you default and you can't pay us the treasury bonds back, we'll just take this collateral. We'll accept residential mortgage-backed securities and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bonds. Right, so the Fed was giving terms for these loans of very liquid, very desirable, considered very safe treasury securities in exchange for what, at this point, people were calling toxic assets. Okay, primary dealer credit facility. So here again, lending to the primary dealers, but this was an overnight loans of actual dollar reserves. So the Fed, if it were going to grant you this kind of a loan, it wasn't lending you treasury securities off of its books. It was just creating new reserves out of thin air by just saying, okay, now your account with us all of a sudden has $100 million more in it than it did 2 seconds ago because we just typed in the digits. So they created dollars out of thin air for this one, whereas, again, the previous slide, there the Fed wasn't creating assets out of nothing. It was taking treasuries that it already held and was saying, here, we're lending these to you for 28 days, and you promised to pay them back to us, and as collateral on that loan, you're putting up these toxic assets that nobody else thinks are worth very much right now. Okay. Maiden Lane Limited Liability Corporations. Okay, so what happened is the Federal Reserve Bank of New York decided it was engaging in such massive bailouts and these huge projects that were focused on certain bailouts, I'm trying to pick my words carefully here, that they wanted to just kind of hold it all in one bucket to keep things organized. All right, so they actually would create a separate company, a separate LLC for these things. All right, so the original one, Maiden Lane, and I think this was named after streets that happened to be near these actual places, was created. So what happened is in early 2008, I guess it was in, I think the bailout actually happened in March. I'm not sure the exact timing about the negotiations and so on, but if you guys remember, if you were paying attention, Bear Stearns was the first household name to go down. All right, so people nowadays think of, oh, when Lehman went down in September of 2008, that was when the world blew up. But things were pretty serious back in March of 2008 when Bear Stearns got taken over. All right, so what happened there is, but it didn't seem like a catastrophe because if you weren't really paying it too much attention, what it looked like happened is just that J.P. Morgan came in and took over Bear Stearns. So yeah, Bear Stearns got in trouble, it was bankrupt, and then J.P. Morgan came in and took it over. And so it looked like, again, if you weren't paying attention. And also another thing is, a lot of these details we didn't know at the time. It was only after the fact, when the Fed was revealing stuff, a lot of times kicking and screaming, did all these details fully come out, and then people realized just how much the Fed was doing behind the scenes to make this happen. So what happened here is, just look at these numbers. In the takeover of Bear Stearns, what people were probably reading in the Wall Street Journal as, oh my gosh, Bear Stearns went down and J.P. Morgan came and took it over. Well, really what happened is in order to get JP Morgan to do it, the New York Fed, I'm speaking loosely here, basically said, okay, we'll take all the crap that Bear Stearns is holding and you just keep the good stuff. You know, so Bear Stearns is sitting there, has a bunch of assets that are now dubious, some assets that are perfectly fine, and then it has a bunch of liabilities that are bigger than that. And the New York Fed came in, lent this new agency, this new LLC, Maiden Lane, $28.82 billion. J.P. Morgan only put up $1.15 billion. And then Maiden Lane, this LLC, bought $30 billion worth of mortgage assets from Bear Stearns. All right, so now this thing, Maiden Lane, is sitting on all these assets that it acquired from Bear Stearns, and that's partly what the Fed's managing. And if you go to the Fed's balance sheet, and I showed you a few weeks ago where you would go if you actually want to see the actual assets and liabilities of all the Federal Reserve banks, one of the entries is Maiden Lane, and then Maiden Lane 2 and Maiden Lane 3. So you can actually still see right now all these assets that Maiden Lane is sitting on that they acquired from this initial rescue of Bear Stearns. And rescue is sort of a misnomer because Bear Stearns doesn't exist anymore. Takeover of Bear Stearns is really the better term. All right, so, but again, just look at the disparity of these numbers, and you can see, so a lot of cynics say this was a gift to J.P. Morgan, that the Fed, the New York Fed, basically approached J.P. Morgan and said, this is going to be awkward if Bear Stearns just blows up, so we want it to look like you just took it over. And then the people at J.P. Morgan went, well, we don't want to take it over. They did a bad job. We don't want to absorb that. There's huge losses sitting on those books waiting to happen. And so then the New York Fed said, all right, well, we'll put up most of the money. And we'll have this Maiden Lane entity buy up a lot of these dubious mortgage-backed assets from Bear, and then you officially take over what's left. Okay, so that's kind of what happened. So from J.P. Morgan's perspective, that's pretty good. She said, sure, I'll take over this. So there's this firm that's going to go under, just left to its own devices. No one else wants to come in and take it over. And now the New York Fed's telling me they're going to create this new entity. I only have to put up $1.15 billion. They're going to put up $28.82. Then that's going to buy $30 billion worth of the garbage that Bear's sitting on, and then I get to take over Bear Stearns. That's not too bad. So the point is, if all those assets default or anything like that, technically now it's this Maiden Lane entity that's going to take the hit, not J.P. Morgan. Okay, Maiden Lane 2, a similar deal this time during the so-called rescue of AIG. So if you remember, September of 2008, the massive insurer AIG now all of a sudden is in trouble. Again, not because of its life insurance policies, not that side of its business, but because of these credit default swaps. It was basically issuing insurance on financial events. So it gets in trouble. The Fed comes in, takes it over. They created this Maiden Lane 2 entity to deal with all that. And then some of the Maiden Lane 3. So here, this one was interesting. Let me just explain these acronyms. To buy collateralized debt obligations. So remember, that's a term that's broader than a mortgage-backed security. So a mortgage-backed security is an example of a CDO. So in here, what it's doing is it's buying them from AIG's counterparties so that AIG can extinguish the credit default swaps. All right, so I'm just going to go through this really fast because we've got a ton of material. Remember, the problem with AIG, I've already said it wasn't their actual underlying life insurance business. That was fine. Superficially, the problem was they had issued all these credit default swaps on all these assets that were now dubious because they were all tied to the mortgage industry somehow or real estate. All these fancy derivatives, and people were just like, uh-oh, now the real estate markets are collapsing. What happens to these derivatives? Because, again, they were hard to price, and things were happening that were not in the computer models that had been originally used to price these things, because they were supposed to be super safe, a lot of them. So what happened is it's not even that AIG was in trouble because these so-called credit events kept happening, and now it had to keep paying off the people who basically bought the insurance. That even wasn't what happened. It was that the people who held all of these credit default swaps were getting nervous that AIG wasn't going to be able to pay them, and so they started saying that AIG put up a bunch of collateral to reassure us that you're going to be able to pay us if the need arises. And then AIG couldn't do that. And that's what ultimately made it untenable for them to continue, and the Fed came in. So again, the analogy I think I used when I explained this to you guys, whether it was last week or 2 weeks ago, saying it's like you're a homeowner and you took out fire insurance, not on your house, but on your neighbor's house, and then you thought that was fine, and then all of a sudden there's a big forest fire that's moving towards the neighborhood, and you realize that the company that you have your policy from on your neighbor's house also issued policies to thousands of other people who have policies on homes in the same neighborhood. So technically the fire hasn't gotten there yet. So technically the fire insurance company doesn't owe you any money and doesn't owe any of your neighbors any money, but you see this fire coming and you realize the sort of thing that's going to burn down the house that I've got insured is also going to burn down thousands of other houses that the same company's on the hook for. So actually, I'm not sure that this piece of paper of them promising to indemnify me is worth anything. So let me call them up and say, hey, do you have a bunch of money set aside in some bank account that's totally free and clear? And can you convince me that you've actually got $200 million put aside to pay all of us off in case this fire hits? Or it'd be more than $200 million, whatever. And then if all their money's tied up in illiquid investments, they could say, well, no, we don't have that. We were kind of hoping that all these houses wouldn't burn down. So that's the analogy. So back to this last bullet point. So what did the Fed do once the Fed took over AIG? It kind of wanted to clean up that garbage and get rid of it. So one thing it did was say, okay, we don't like having all these CDOs out there on which the credit default swaps are based, or that they're insuring against default on these things. So what we're going to do is buy up the CDOs from the counterparties. Okay, so it's like the fire insurance company wants to retract all of these policies now that it's issued because it sees the fire coming. So what it does is it goes to the owners of those buildings and says, hey, we want to buy the building off you. And so then it starts buying up all those buildings. And then if you're an owner and you had insured your own building and then you sold it to them, now, you know, it can say, well, at this point you don't care if the thing happens, right? So let me extinguish this event, or the credit default swap, right? That's, I'm being a little bit loose with the facts there. And also the analogy doesn't quite work because you can insure against something you don't own with a credit default swap. But that's kind of what was going on in this last bullet point, was made in lane three. Is they were trying to neutralize the thing that the counterparties to AIG were insuring against happening to make it easier just to collect all those outstanding credit default swaps and lower the liability, basically, that the AIG was still facing, or that Maiden Lane II was facing now. Okay, Operation Twist. I see someone asking in the comments about AIG, and this came up last year, and I was never able to really get a good answer for this. The question is, what was the actual contractual relationship? How could it be that AIG's counterparties, and when I say counterparty, I think most of you probably know what that means, but just in case, it means like the other person who's party to the contract. So when AIG issues a credit default swap, the party that buys it is the counterpart. Okay, so the question is, how come they could all say to AIG, hey, put up more collateral, such that when they all said that at the same time, now all of a sudden AIG can't run its business anymore? And the quick answer is, I don't know. And I did try to research that. I am very confident that that is what happened. In other words, I've read that in a few places from people who really seemed like they know what they were talking about. So it really was that it was these collateral calls that brought AIG to its knees, not that all these credit events, boom, 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 kept happening and they kept having to write checks to people. That wasn't what happened. It was the collateral calls, but I don't know exactly how that worked, and like, was that part of the contract, or was it just that these firms were such big customers that basically if they said, well, if you don't put that collateral up, then we're not doing any more business with you, and that's what killed them. I don't know exactly what it means to say its counterparties wanted more collateral, AIG couldn't put it up, and therefore the Fed needed to come and take it over. I don't know exactly, like I said, if it was a legally binding thing or just, I mean, because it was big firms like, I think like J.P. Morgan and stuff like that. So, I mean, it wasn't like some little mom and pop shop that was calling up AIG and saying, hey, you better make me happy. It was like these humongous firms that were its main clients. And so it could have just been something like they said, all right, well, we're not doing business with you anymore. And then maybe that killed it too. But again, I don't know the exact specifics. I could never quite nail that down. Okay. Okay, someone's saying in the comments it was mandated in their ISDA and CSA agreements that collateral did have to be posted. Okay, so apparently that was part of the contractual arrangement. Okay, on to Operation Twist. So the original Operation Twist began in 1961, and yes, at least according to Wikipedia, they named it that because of the dance craze at the time. And, you know, come on, baby, let's do the twist. It goes like this. So what is the point of it was the intent was to flatten the yield curve. So the idea is that the Fed is not on net changing its total holdings of assets, so it doesn't need to issue more dollar reserves. Its balance sheet is not growing in dollar terms. All that's happening is it's changing the maturity, so it's selling off short-term bonds and buying longer-term ones. All right, so it'll sell, making the numbers up, $100 million worth of Treasury securities that mature in 3 months or less, and it'll buy $100 million worth of Treasury securities that will mature in 20 years or later. Again, I'm making those numbers up. All right, so the point of that is, other things equal, you would say, okay, if they're selling off short-term bonds, what does that do? Well, if you sell them, that pushes down their price, but for a bond, if the price goes down, that means the yield goes up. So that means short-term interest rates would tend to go up. And at the same time, they're then buying long-term bonds, so that pushes up their price and pushes down their yield. So the theory was they're going to raise short interest rates and push down long-term rates. So if you think about what the yield curve is, that would flatten the yield curve, because remember, the so-called normal yield curve is upward sloping. So if you raise short rates and push down long rates, you're making the overall yield curve flatter. So that was the theory. What was funny is the economics literature, looking back on that operation, considered it a failure, meaning they didn't think it really did what it was supposed to do. And one of the academics who has written on that episode was Ben Bernanke, saying how Operation Twist in the 1960s didn't work. So I haven't read his paper. I don't know if he makes a compelling argument. But the point is, Ben Bernanke is published as saying Operation Twist didn't work. And yet, after the September 2011 meeting, the Fed announced it was going to do now a modern Operation Twist to the tune of $400 billion. So what it's going to do, buy six bonds that had a maturity ranging from 6 years up to 30 years, and then sell treasury bonds that had a maturity of 3 years or less. But again, they're going to do it in the same dollar amount, just changing the composition of its holdings. And so why would they do that? Because, remember, normal Fed operations, when the economy is bad, when unemployment's too high, and price inflation doesn't seem like it's getting on hand, what is the Fed supposed to do according to textbook theory? It's supposed to buy treasuries and push down interest rates. But if you push it and get more specific, then what kind of treasuries, what kind of interest rates? Usually they, you mean, oh, the federal funds rate. That's the rate that's being targeted. Because under normal circumstances, at some point, you're going to push the federal funds rate low enough that if you went lower than that, that would stimulate aggregate demand so much that you'd have start having rising price inflation faster than you wanted as the Fed policymaker. And so you're going to hit that trade-off point where, okay, we're doing everything we can to stimulate. That's going to pull down unemployment, create jobs, blah, blah, blah. Because if we put in any more gas, prices would start taking off faster than we want them to. And so we're not going to pump in any more money, and we're not going to push interest rates any lower, by which you mean the federal funds rate. But the screwy thing about the current crisis, again, in standard Fed jargon and the way that the Fed looks at the world, or at least the way they officially tell us they look at the world, the standard sort of New Keynesian theory, holy cow, we pushed the federal funds rate down to zero, and the economy's still awful. Unemployment's still way too high, and price inflation not only isn't going through the roof, we're still worried about deflation. So we clearly need to do more, but we sort of have hit a wall on the short end of the yield curve. We can't push short rates down any further. So what the heck do we do? Oh, I know, let's push down long rates, because it's still the case maybe we could get more investment if long-term interest rates were lower. Maybe that would stimulate more investment. Maybe that would get consumers to go buy durable goods or to go buy more, you know, housing or something. So maybe we could push mortgage rates down more if we could push down the yield curve further out on the curve. That's the thinking. But they didn't want to stoke fears of price inflation, and so they said, we're not actually expanding the Fed balance sheet. This isn't QE3. It's Operation Twist. We're buying $400 billion of long-term securities, but we're selling $400 billion of short-term. So don't freak out, Ron Paul. Don't freak out, you gold bugs. The Fed's not getting bigger here. It's just changing the composition of what it's buying or what it's holding. So that was the deal. That was the theory behind it. Okay, so you can look and see, let's see what happened here. So the question we're asking is, did the Fed Operation Twist make the yield curve get flatter? So, again, with all this stuff, really to do it correctly, you'd want to know, when did people in the bond market think that this was the new policy? Because technically, if everyone heard about it 2 weeks before it was officially announced, people would be working behind the scenes and buying and selling so that you'd see bond prices responding even before the Fed officially announced the news. Okay, but since we don't really know, or I don't really know how to tease all that out, let's just at face value go and look from the moment of the announcement what happened to the yield curve. So the red line here is the DGS1, which is 1 year treasury yield, and the blue line is the 30-year yield. And let's just refresh our memory. So this was on November of 2011, and so this is about what? June, so what, 7, 8, 9, 10, something like that. So it's right around in here that the announcement happened. So do you see what's funny about that picture? Does anyone in the comments see? Anybody? Bueller? Oh, wait, I'm doing it wrong. I'm looking at the wrong year. Yeah, I thought so. It's over here. I was in 2010 there. Here it is. So it's hard to see. I mean, if you wanted to credit this right here, you could say that that pushed it down and that this was the operation twist. But again, with this stuff, it's tricky because it looks like if you did the exact timing, it would look like it had no effect. But I know that the people who thought it worked are going to look at this drop beforehand and say people thought it was coming. Yeah. See, I'm glad you guys were paying attention. That was a trick question. I was in the wrong year. Okay, sterilization. That's probably what threw me because I knew it was supposed to make it look like it worked, and then I was like, why is it going up? Okay. Sterilization, let me just make sure you guys understand this term. So if you see, just be careful with these dates here. So remember, as far back as December of 2007 is when the Fed started doing these extraordinary programs. And so you can see that here. Let me make sure I don't screw up the date again. So if this is January of 2008, December is right in here, and good, that lines up with the chart. Okay, so this is, again, where the Fed starts doing these unusual, extraordinary programs. Again, big picture, the Fed is not simply buying more treasuries to put reserves into the system to push down the federal funds rate. That clearly isn't enough, and so it's doing all kinds of other things. But like I said last time, remember also, the federal funds rate was not at zero or even 25 basis points before the Fed started doing all this crazy stuff. So it's not quite right to say the Fed was trying standard textbook theory, but oh no, since we're in a liquidity trap and interest rates got pushed down to zero, then the Fed had to start brainstorming. No, the Fed was doing all kinds of stuff behind the scenes to bail out the big financial institutions who were sitting on these toxic assets well before the federal funds rate got pushed down to zero. I mean, they were doing it basically a year earlier. So to me, it's not simply that the evidence does not at all support the hypothesis that Bernanke really isn't trying to help the bankers per se. He's just trying to stimulate the economy, and he ran out of conventional ammunition, so then he switched to something new. That's not what was going on here. He was directly bailing out, giving special favors to big financial institutions well before textbook theory had run its course. Okay, but this issue of sterilization, let me make sure you know what that means. So what this whole picture is here is showing the Fed's balance sheet over time and then its composition according to the color coding. So you can see these different colors in the chart correspond down here to all sorts of different types of assets. So it's trying to show you. So at any given time, this line here, it starts going way up and then it comes down and starts going up again, is the total. And so if you looked over here at the axis, you would see what's the total size of the Fed's balance sheet. But then the respective height at any given slice of time of the various colors correspond to how much of that particular asset was on the Fed's balance sheet at that moment in time. So you can see that normally, you know, starting in 2007 and going through there, just about everything the Fed's holding were conventional treasury securities, this sort of beige-brown color. But then, starting in December of 2007, you start seeing an enlarging of these other colors. And if you went down and looked here, you could see, and if you really want to, you can backtrack and look at the slides and see when each new program started, and then that will correspond in this color key to when that's started up, if you get what I'm saying. So the point I'm making with this sterilization is, if you look, the Fed's balance sheet total didn't really change much from December 2007 all the way up to about September of 2008. And then it just took off like a rocket. So what was happening? How is that possible? How can it be that from December 2007 to September of 2008, the Fed starts taking on all these mortgage-backed securities and, you know, all this crap from Bear Stearns through the Maiden Lane program and blah, blah, blah? How can it be doing all that stuff if its total balance sheet isn't growing by a significant amount? Well, because it was either lending out or outright selling its treasury holdings. So you can see this thing goes down, and then it only starts going up in the new year, in 2009. All right, so does everyone see how that works? So that's what people mean in this context by sterilization, is they're saying they're not trying to, they don't want to put more total reserves into the system, but they do want to make these targeted interventions in particular asset markets. So if the Fed in December of 2007 and then up through March 2008 is saying, oh my gosh, the residential mortgage-backed securities market is collapsing and there's a bunch of major household financial names holding a lot of these residential mortgage-backed securities, and if one of them goes down, there's going to be a chain reaction because that market's going to dry up, and then that stuff sitting on all these books of these other major household financial firms are going to get marked down. They're all going to be insolvent, and it's just going to blow up. So we don't want to, you know, push down the federal funds rate by 200 basis points to stop this one little thing. Why don't we come in and just do a targeted, why don't we nip this in the bud right at the source? If we could just go in and stop the collapse in the price of residential mortgage-backed securities, then everything else would be fine. We would stop this chain reaction before it started, before it rippled out into the whole credit market and then brought down the real economy. And so to them, or again, this is the official justification. I mean, it could have just been their buddies were in trouble and they said, well, we're going to rescue you. Don't worry about it. But the way they would explain to an academic audience what they did, and they would say, all right, it would have been, you know, using a machine gun to kill a mosquito if the way we dealt with this falling apart of Bear Stearns or wherever is just try to lower interest rates and buy a bunch of treasuries and hope that somehow indirectly would help the Bear Stearns credit markets get unclogged. So we went right to the source. And in fact, because overall conditions did not warrant pushing down interest rates, like unemployment wasn't that bad as of March 2008, so, and it wasn't like price inflation was dangerously low. So if it weren't for this fire building in the credit markets, the Fed wouldn't have done anything, right? It's not like they would have announced an interest rate cut. So they're saying, what we're going to do, we want to be able to buy up these residential mortgage-backed securities and other so-called toxic assets to put a floor on those prices to reassure credit markets, to unclog credit channels, to keep lending happening. We don't want, like, the commercial paper market to dry up and so forth. So what we're going to do, we're going to take all this crap on our balance sheet, but we're going to simultaneously sell off a bunch of treasuries, or we're going to get them off our books by lending them short-term loans to primary dealers and stuff like that so that our total balance sheet doesn't change much. So we're not changing total reserves in the system, so we're not putting downward pressure on the federal funds rate. Right, so that's what was going on in this period. But then from September of 2008 onward, they decided we do want at the same time to be holding more and more of these types of assets, and we're okay with our balance sheet growing. And so that's why the total then expanded. And so this massive rise in all these types of assets the Fed was holding was not counterbalanced by a corresponding drop in the totalings of treasuries. And then with the announcement of QE1 in March of 2009, the holdings of treasuries started zooming back up too. Okay. No, somebody's asking, that particular chart was not from Fred, that's from the Federal Reserve itself. So if you just go to Google and say something like Fed balance sheet over time, you'll probably get that chart or some version of it. All right, let me go real fast through this. Last year when I taught this course, this rule change had just occurred, and so I spent a lot of time on it. Remember, this was the deal where the Fed in January of 2011 in its normal update had this very obscure, jargon-laden announcement that made it look like it was just some petty little thing, and then bloggers a couple weeks later were like, holy cow, do you know what this means? And so I just walked through a simple example here to show you what could be at stake. All right, so with the time we have, I'm not going to spell this thing out, but the point I just want to, I'll say it now, and then later if you really want to go through it, you can get the video of this. So just imagine the Fed starting out with this balance sheet. It's got $2 trillion in government bonds and its assets, and then on the liability side, $1 trillion of outstanding pieces of paper, $950 billion in commercial banks reserves on deposit with the Fed, and $50 billion in capital. Okay, so $2 trillion and $2 trillion, everything balances. Now, suppose that there is a $70 billion reduction in the market value of the Fed's holdings. And how could that happen? Well, if interest rates rise, right? The Fed's sitting on $2 trillion worth of government securities, and then for whatever reason, the yield on government securities goes up. Well, that means their market value goes down. Since the Fed's sitting on $2 trillion of them, that interest rate move, conceivably, depending on how big it is and depending on the maturity of the bonds they're holding, could reduce their value by $70 billion. So if that were to happen, before that January 6, 2011 rule change, just the way you would standard, you know, do a standard accounting treatment of that, okay, if your assets go down by $70 billion, well, that means on the right-hand side, the total has to go down by $70 billion. Your liabilities obviously didn't change, so that means your capital goes down. And if before it was $50 billion, now you're in the hole $20 billion, so you're insolvent. But with that rule change, the way I believe they would handle it, and this is what those financial bloggers were pointing out, now the way the Fed says it's going to handle that, and again, the Fed never said they're going to handle losses like this. They were kept talking about this is the way we're going to handle gains. And so but this is what the bloggers picked up on. They were like, well, wait a minute. If that's the way you're going to handle gains, hypothetically speaking, if there were a big loss on your asset side, this is what would happen. And so that's why us being cynical and thinking the worst of Ben Bernanke thought this may have been the whole reason all along, and they were just couching it in terms of gains to make it fly under the radar. But anyway, suppose now, given the rule change in the accounting treatment after the January 6, 2011 announcement, I think this is how they would handle a hypothetical $70 billion drop in their assets. So the asset side still gets marked down. The right-hand side still gets marked down. So it's still true that you've got double-entry bookkeeping. Assets are $1.93 trillion or so, liabilities plus capital. But wait a minute. Their capital is still being listed at $50 billion. So they're still solvent. They're not bankrupt. They're not insolvent. What's the problem? So you say, well, what happened to the $70 billion loss? They're going to list it now as a negative liability. So they're listing it not under their capital, not under shareholders' equity, but under the liabilities column. And since they need it to be a negative number, because they have to make the summation go down, because before it was $2 trillion, they have to list it as a negative entry. So they're saying, we owe the Treasury negative $70 billion. And so over time, as they earn income, as their assets mature and they earn an income flow from them. Normally, remember, after they pay the janitor and pay the dividend to the commercial banks and whatever that are members, whatever's left over, they remit to the Treasury. Well, now, before they actually transfer money, that's just going to whittle down this negative liability. So if next quarter they were supposed to give $10 billion to the Treasury, they're not actually going to send the Treasury a check. Instead, they're just going to take this negative $70 billion and make it negative $60 billion. And then the next quarter, if they earn a $15 billion profit when all is said and done, and that's what they would normally give the Treasury, then that $60 billion, that negative $60 billion is going to increase to negative $45 billion, and so on, until finally they whittle it down to zero. And then from that point going forward, when they earn income, then they would remit to the Treasury. They'll actually send it to the Treasury. All right. So that's – you can't do that with normal accounting. You can't just say, well – I mean, basically what they're doing is they're transferring the loss to the Treasury, and they're making the Treasury eat it and make up for it over time. Okay. The creature's ancestors – meaning the creature being the creature from Jekyll Island. So here, this is just, I don't have any particular comparative advantage in this, so I'm just going to fly through some of these slides. This is just standard history that you can dig up. So the first Bank of the United States was chartered by Congress in 1791, had a 20-year charter. It was proposed by Alexander Hamilton. There was this dubious stock deal the federal government was involved in. It was opposed by, who was at the time, the Secretary of State, Jefferson. Let me just say this in case you guys aren't aware. When you are getting your standard sixth grade American history lesson, Alexander Hamilton is touted as this giant of finance and this, you know, founding father and stuff like that. And hey, he's on our money and everything. But if you subscribe to Austrian economics and libertarianism, you actually will hate Alexander Hamilton. I mean, he was not a free market guy by any stretch. And so once you get into that history and don't just think that, oh, all the founding fathers were awesome, then you see this dichotomy between the views of Hamilton and those of Thomas Jefferson, who actually, I mean, he had his flaws, but actually was really pretty good from a modern libertarian perspective. Okay. But because it had this 20-year charter, what did that mean? That once the 20 years was up, they had to renew it to keep the thing alive, and it didn't get renewed. So it collapsed. Or not collapsed, but expired. Okay. The second Bank of the United States was chartered by Congress in 1816 because of debt from the War of 1812. So, again, showing the connection between central banking and war, that the federal government needs a central bank in order to sop up its bonds because it has to issue a lot of bonds during wartime. Again, a 20-year charter. It was a private bank, but it held deposits to the federal government, and it was run with an iron fist by this guy, Nicholas Biddle. And there was a great story about Andrew Jackson, Old Hickory, and how when he ran for re-election, he made it a major plank that in his re-election bid, that he was not going to renew the bank's charter. He was basically running against the Second Bank of the United States. All right, we'll come back to that in a minute. The National Currency Acts, these were originally passed in 1863 and amended in 64. So it wasn't a national bank per se, in terms of one central bank. They allowed for nationally chartered banks, which could issue these things called national bank notes, and that's what people refer to as greenbacks, if you've ever heard of that. And so if you read histories about paper money in the United States and experiences with runaway inflation, you may see a treatment of the so-called greenbacks during what's called the Civil War. And so that's what this is referring to. So, and this is, you know, you may have heard in this McAuliffe versus Maryland and the, you know, the power to tax and the power to destroy and all that kind of stuff. So what part of that involved is these national bank acts in order to give an advantage to the nationally chartered banks so that their notes would be preferred to notes issued by state chartered banks. The National Bank Acts or the National Currency Acts allowed for the taxation of the state-backed notes at 10%. And so that was led to lawsuits and so forth. All right, and then it also created the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency inside the Treasury Department. Okay, the Panic of 1819. This is Rothbard's doctoral dissertation, and as Rothbard was fond of pointing out, this is the standard reference to, I was going to say till this day, to the day when I heard him give a speech to that effect. Presumably no one has updated it since then. So the point is, if you're into this kind of stuff and you just go and ask some historian of business cycles or something, hey, I'm interested in the Panic of 1819, what do I read? I believe if the person knows what he's talking about, that he'd say, oh yeah, Murray Rothbard's treatment is, you know, the seminal work in this area. So it's not just a bunch of, oh my gosh, the government sucks. I mean, it's a historical, scholarly treatment. Okay, so this is a good example of how the government intervened and caused the financial panics in the 19th century, even without invoking a central bank and with its modern powers. Because even the first bank of the U.S. and the second bank of the U.S., they were not as powerful as the Federal Reserve. And even the Federal Reserve, when it was first founded, was not as powerful as it would later become. So, you know, I told you in the 30s it was reorganized to centralize power and become more of just a single agency, whereas in its original conception, the Federal Reserve really was disparate banks that kind of had their own policies. But then even what Bernanke is doing now, of course, is inconceivable compared to the stuff that they thought the Fed could do in the 30s. So what I'm saying is, in the 19th century, even in periods when the first bank of the U.S. or the second bank of the U.S. Existed, those things weren't as powerful as the Fed is. That's what I'm trying to get at. But so you say, well, how could there be business cycles then? According to you Austrians, the government was still involved in many ways. All right, so the banks did inflate to pay for the War of 1812. And so the government suspended the state bank's obligations to redeem notes in specie in 1814. So here, again, we see specific interventions that reduce the market's normal check on inflation, on fraction reserve banking. So state chartered banks, which you might think, well, come on, how can you Austrians explain a business cycle generated by state chartered banks? Well, because the government relieve their obligations, right? So they had inflated. They had issued a bunch of banknotes that said the holder of this can go to any of our branches and turn it in for gold or silver. I would have to go. I don't know if it was both or if it was one or the other. I don't know enough about the topic. But they were redeemable in hard coin according to what the note said on it. But the banks inflated too much, and then there's the collapse, and everybody's going to the bank saying, okay, I got this note from you. It says I can turn this in for coin. Give it to me. And the banks say, oh, actually, we can't. And so did they go out of business, and did the financial sector learn a lesson that, okay, don't inflate so much next time because then you get driven out of business and you get taken over and your assets get divided among the creditors? No, the government just said, ah, you don't have to do that. Because it's a, you know, wartime emergency, all that kind of stuff. We can't have the whole financial sector collapsing. Banking is essential to commerce, so don't worry about it. And so, like, if someone tried to take the bank to court saying, hey, I showed up and said, give me my coin, and they wouldn't do it, it wouldn't matter. The government relieved them of their contractual obligations. All right, and so then just you see some statistics about the level of the inflation and how it caused a speculative boom. And then what's funny is the Second Bank of the U.S. established in 1860, one of its ostensible reasons or rationales was to contain the inflation, you know. So, oh my gosh, we have all these wildcat state chartered banks running around inflating like crazy. We can't have that. We need a federal central institution to keep them all in check. Right? That's because obviously you can't have laissez-faire banking, because look at all this inflation they produced during the War of 1812. This is crazy. This is capitalism for you. We need to have smart, regulated capitalism. All right, Old Hickory slays the bank. So Andrew Jackson, 7th president of the U.S., he was a general in the War of 1812, nicknamed Old Hickory. A few things about him. He paid off the national debt when he was president. Okay, so I don't mean he balanced the budget. I'm saying he balanced the budget and ran so many budget surpluses that he literally paid off the national debt. Uncle Sam didn't owe anybody any money after Andrew Jackson, right? And that was never reproduced. In other words, the national debt started going up again, and then it has never been zero since. He was a champion of hard money. If you want to see more about him, I have a treatment in my book that I have a co-author with Carlos, that I co-authored with Carlos Lara, called How Privatized Banking Really Works. If you just Google that and type in free PDF, you know, you don't have to buy it. We've got the PDF out there, and search for Andrew Jackson. There's, you know, I tell the story there. It's some cool stuff. And I was drawing heavily on the Mises.org article that Danny Sanchez, our own Danny Sanchez, wrote up. So anyway, Andrew Jackson's really cool as far as hard money guy. It's not just his particular policies, but like his speeches explaining why he had those views was really good. The book was called How Privatized Banking Really Works. If you go to my website at Free Advice and you look on the left, there's a link for it. Okay, having said all that, I know a lot of modern Austro-libertarians talk about Andrew Jackson, rah, rah, rah. I mean, he's also the same guy that was behind a trail of tears, all right? So he was a butcher. I mean, he was a general. And so he's not – let's just be careful before we elevate him into the list of libertarian saints. Okay, so Daniel Sanchez is the guy at Mises.org who wrote about that. So he's got a great Mises.org. Called something like the 19th century Bernanke, and I forgot to check. I'm pretty sure we signed this in the either the mandatory or the optional reading for this week. Okay, if you want to see more, believe it or not, Tom Woods' book Meltdown, if you've never actually read that thing, has, I mean, it's little snippets, but tantalizing nonetheless, little explanations of how can you Austrians explain business cycles by blaming the Fed if there were business cycles before the Fed? And so he's got some stuff. And like I say, it was shocking to me because I got the book after it had already been established as a New York Times bestseller. And I kind of just thought, oh, yeah, sure. I'm sure Tom did a great job just giving our message for explaining the housing boom. And he spends some time in the beginning going into the history talking about 19th century bank panics. Like, I was astounded that he got away with doing that in something that they were hoping would be a bestseller and turned out to be a bestseller. So anyway, Tom Wood shows it's okay to be a nerd, I guess is what I'm getting at. If you're really an earnest nerd, you will get away with it, and the people will love you that much more for it. Okay. Tom and I both have really been stressing the 1920-21 Depression versus the Great Depression, because it's almost too good to be true. And a Keynesian would say, yeah, you're right, it is too good to be true. You Austrians should shut up about it. But when I started looking into this, when I was doing my own book, Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, I don't even remember what set me on this path. I don't know if Tom did something on this first or if we independently started working. I don't remember. But the point is, all of the reasons that both Keynesians and monetarists give for why the Great Depression either happened or was so awful, those, if you believed in those explanations, then you would probably think, looking at what the Federal Reserve and the federal government did during the 1920 and 21 Depression, that should have, the 20s should have been far worse than the 30s. And yet, it's the exact opposite. The 1920s are called the Roaring 20s. And the 1930s, of course, are considered the Great Depression, the most miserable decade in U.S. economic history. So, anyway, let's just go through some of this. First of all, I'm going to come back to this point. I don't know why I put that bullet point first. Let me go through the standard Austrian talking points, and then hopefully I'll remember to come back to this. I just want you to be aware of what the Keynesian response is. Okay, so from January 1918 to January 1920, the CPI went up 38%. All right, so a 38% increase in consumer prices over 24 months is pretty big. So, so what happened is, make sure you remember the timeline, World War I ends. So going into World War I, the Fed is given the green light to start buying government bonds. They buy them like crazy in the secondary market. Federal government runs humongous deficits, the biggest ones by far up to that point in U.S. history. The federal debt balloons. They jack up the top income tax rate. When the personal income tax was introduced in 1913, the top marginal tax rate was 7%. By 1918, it had risen to 77%. Right? When they introduced that income tax, and they had to do a constitutional amendment to do it, no politician got on radio, I was going to say got on TV, and said, yeah, right now it's at 7%, but maybe 5 years from now we're going to be taxing the top income bracket at 77%. Nobody said that. They were saying, this is just a little morsel. We're taking a crumb from the bread of the super rich. Don't worry. No one had any inkling that within a mere 5 years, they were going to be taxing the top income earners at 77 cents out of the dollar. All right, but that's what the war to end war did. So all this money they're pumping in, all this huge spending, when the war ends, the Fed needs to get price inflation under control, and the government slashes spending because, you know, they were spending like crazy to fund the war effort. So from fiscal year 1919 to 1920, federal spending was slashed by 65%. You understand what I'm saying? In 1 year, the federal government's budget was reduced 65%. Okay. Another thing, you say, oh, what happens during a bad recession is when, like, the Fed cuts interest rates, right? No, the New York Fed raised the discount rate to a record high 7% by June of 1920. So not only were they not cutting rates fast enough to maintain aggregate demand, they jacked rates up to record highs during what is called in the history books as the Depression of 1920 and 21. And the collapse in the monetary base was the biggest in U.S. history, which I'll show you in the next few slides. Okay, so why are these facts relevant? Because when it comes to the Great Depression, what does the Keynesian say? The Keynesian says, oh, well, what happened is there was the financial crash, aggregate demand collapsed, and Herbert Hoover didn't do enough. Yeah, sure, you Austrians can point out that Herbert Hoover ran unprecedented peacetime budget deficits, but they weren't big enough. He just should have had bigger deficits, and that's what would have prevented us from falling into the Great Depression, but shucks, his deficits weren't all that big. Yeah, he increased spending, but just not enough, and that's why this bad financial panic turned into the Great Depression. So if that's true, you would think that the federal government cutting its budget by 65% in a single year should have caused the most catastrophic economic collapse in U.S. history by far. And yet, by 23, we were in full-blown recovery. So how can it be that Herbert Hoover's increases in spending were just, oh, too little, too late, and that's why we had the Great Depression, but during the Depression of 1920 and 21, when the federal government slashed spending 65%, it causes a real sharp, severe, but short depression, and then boom, everything's fine, and the economy starts growing again. So that's odd. But now, what about the monetarists? Milton Friedman, those guys. Their explanation for the Great Depression is that the Fed didn't inflate enough. And they'll say, yeah, the Fed did inflate, but it was too little, too late, because the demand for money went up, and bank panics, you know, the banks were collapsing, and the overall M2 collapsed. So the Fed should have really jacked up the monetary base, and it really just didn't do enough. Well, okay. If increasing the monetary base, but inadequately, is what gives you the Great Depression, well, then surely jacking up interest rates to all-time highs at that moment and allowing the biggest monetary or big collapse of the monetary base in U.S. history, and I don't just mean up to that point, I mean ever, you would think that should surely be worse and cause a worse crisis than what happened in the 30s. But no, it was over in 2 years. So that's what I mean when I say it's almost too good to be true, that you would think it would be harder to come up with a better example of trying so-called austerity measures versus Keynesian easing measures, counter-cyclical policy. It's harder to come up with two starker examples and then to see two sets of results that are more different. You know, it's not like we're saying, well, gee, it's not really clear whether the 1920s or the 30s were better economically. It's kind of a judgment call. No. Clearly, the 1920s was healthier economically than the 1930s. So that's what I mean. Now, having said all that stuff, this top bullet point, what the Keynesians can say somewhat plausibly in response to this and what they have said is, wait a minute, you guys are confusing cause and effect. The federal government cutting spending after the war ended and the Federal Reserve jacking up interest rates, those are what caused the Great Depression, the Depression of 1920 and 21. So it wasn't like there was this financial collapse, like the stock market collapse and all these bank failures that then policymakers were supposed to deal with. It was, things were going along fine, it was just the federal government was consuming a huge portion of GDP with the wartime economy, and the Fed, by pumping in so much money, had caused really high price inflation. It was running at, I think, 20% annually, going from 1919 to 1920. And so to get that inflationary boom under control, they jacked up interest rates and slashed spending. And, yeah, that caused a two-year depression, after which things resumed. But they're going to say, because the underlying economy was okay, whereas in 1929, the whole credit market started collapsing, and that's a much different fish to fry, or whatever metaphor you want to use. All right, so that's one thing the Keynesians could plausibly say to try to diffuse this great set of talking points that we Austrians have comparing the two depressions. All right, so I still think it's worth pointing these things out. Because if nothing else, it shows you the economy is pretty nimble. And back when you didn't, you know, when people say, oh, no, wages are sticky, you can say, well, they weren't sticky in 1922, right? Because unemployment was high in 1920, the peak, I don't remember exactly off the top of my head when the peak was. I think it was in late 1920. And then unemployment came down pretty quickly. And how did it do it? It's because wages fell. So even in the midst of large price deflation, larger price deflation than in any comparable period during the Great Depression, all of a sudden the labor market healed itself. And why? Well, because wages fell even faster. So yeah, you had price deflation, the dreaded deflationary spiral that everyone's freaking out about now, and that the Great Depression is blamed on, or that is blamed for the Great Depression. But you had, in a one-year interval, prices fall even harder in this period I'm talking about, and it didn't blow up things. What happened is wages just fell faster, and labor markets cleared. Imagine that. So that's why I really like studying this, because it shows if you have a basic free market environment, you can have these things that are supposedly catastrophic. And yeah, the economy is awful for a year, and then it recovers. And not only does it recover, but it leads to some of the biggest advances in standard of living in U.S. history. I mean, because they did stuff like electrification and introducing the car to a lot of people during the 1920s, widespread adoption of radio and so forth. Okay. I see some people in the comments asking about Woodrow Wilson. Yeah, Wilson was in office for a portion of this time, and then Harding was in there. So it's not like this is just a pure Republican thing. Woodrow Wilson was in office when some of this stuff started. Okay, let's see here. Why am I showing you this? Oh, yeah. I want to show you, look at. So this is monetary base percent change from a year ago. So you can see this collapse here. So this coincides with when the Fed jacked up interest rates to record highs at the time, record highs. That's the biggest drop ever. You know what I'm saying? The one-year drop, the year-to-year change in the monetary base, that was the lowest drop ever. And then here, you might say, oh, but what's going on here? Well, first of all, it's not quite as low. And then if we zoom in on that, you can see when the timing was. This was because of what happened, the policy change in 1937. When the Fed, among other things, doubled the reserve ratio requirements. All right, so a monetarist can plausibly cite that decision as causing the double dip, which caused the 1938 depression within a depression. But it really makes no sense to say, oh, the Great Depression was because of the Fed's inadequacy in pumping up the monetary base, when you can see what happened there. And yet, like we said, by 1923, the economy is in full-blown recovery. One little thing also, I would need to double-check here, but I believe you might be wondering what's going on right here. So you can see the Fed did allow the monetary base to contract a little bit in this period. And I think, like I said, I would need to go double check the numbers, but I think what that is when Great Britain went off the gold standard, then the Federal Reserve actually had to start raising interest rates. Because what happened is Great Britain goes off the gold standard, and that was kind of like, oh my gosh. And then so everyone starts worrying, is America going to be next? And so people started withdrawing their gold from the, turning in their dollars and taking gold out. And so the Federal Reserve had to raise interest rates to make it more attractive to keep your assets in dollars, so to speak. All right, so that's what happened, and that's why Keynesians and monetarists will say the gold standard was partly responsible for the Great Depression, because they'll say the Fed's hands were tied at this point here. We're still on the gold standard, because remember, they didn't leave gold until, I don't know what the scale is here. In March of 1933, somewhere around there, is when the U.S. officially leaves the gold standard. So up until that point, the Fed can, probably I can tell you where it is. It's probably right here. That's probably where that big spike is, when the Fed probably left the gold standard, or U.S. left the gold standard. So you can partly see their, in my view, very short-sighted view, but what they're getting at is at that point, I think it was like September of 31 or October of 31, something like that, when the Fed starts raising interest rates. Because initially the Fed was lowering interest rates after the stock market collapse and everything. They were trying to ease things, and it wasn't working. And then they started raising them again, and clearly the economy was not healthy when they were raising them. And so the people who don't like the gold standard were saying, well, yeah, that's because their hands were tied. That's why the gold standard's stupid, because you can find yourself in a situation like that where your gold reserves are getting depleted, and then you got to raise interest rates exactly the time you don't want to raise interest rates if you're a Keynesian. Okay. And then the last thing I will leave you with is, if you want to know more about the 1920-21 episode and a lot of what happened with the gold standard in the 20s and the early 30s, and, of course, all the shenanigans of the New Deal, I've literally written a book on the subject. And if I do say so, there is some stuff in there that is not anywhere else. So, of course, I relied heavily on Rothbard's treatment. But Rothbard only covers Hoover. He doesn't get into the New Deal. And the comparison, like taking the monetarist explanation of the Great Depression and just picking that apart, I haven't seen anyone else do it in such excruciating detail as I did it in this book. And again, relying heavily on the 1920-21 episode to show, well, wait a minute, if Milton Friedman's right about this, then that means, you know, 1923 through 26 should have been awful too, and yet it wasn't. Yeah, and last thing people are asking me, how come there's not a free PDF of this? Well, because the Mises Institute didn't publish it. This is Regnery Publisher, so they don't play that game. So that's why. Okay, we're over time at this point, so thank you everyone for taking the course. I will get your questions answered in the Moodle forum. And I will post, so remember, if you're taking the class for credit, there will be a quiz 8 for this week, and then next week I will post a final. All right, so I will give you email blast telling you about all this stuff, but just realize there's going to be two things remaining. There's going to be the quiz 8 just for this week's material, and then the final covering everything, and I will, like I say, send out an email telling you how do I study for the final, what kind of stuff's going to be on it, what do I expect, that sort of stuff. Okay, and yeah, somebody's asking, there will be office hours this Saturday, and when I announce quiz 8 being posted, I'll tell you when. Okay, thank you everybody, and the Fed. Let's give it up for Paul Ryan, huh? Little joke there for everybody. Okay. Probably turn off the recording.